I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, groups are banding together to make sure the parental rights law gets a proper defense. Plus, a controversial kids' catwalk event got canceled. And a black-owned coffee shop in Seattle says it is being destroyed by liberal policies and taxes. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Hello, 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 and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Another week, another effort to restore sanity in the great state of Washington. There was at least one event that would have been insane over the weekend that did not happen that I was very glad to hear. We talked on the show last week about how the city of Linwood, Snohomish County, they were hosting a pride event over the weekend, and it was supposed to include a catwalk for children as young as 2 years old to strut their stuff in front of adults. Well, I'm happy to report that the kids' catwalk was canceled, but the event was still very unhinged. If you were looking for maybe, I don't know, middle-aged Bob Ferguson supporters strutting their stuff on a catwalk with Bob Ferguson signs, well, then this pride event had just about everything you could ever hope for. It was interesting because it was obviously billed as sort of a nonpartisan event, but it was an incredibly partisan event. Our friend Jonathan Cho was there, and a lot of Democratic booths, Bob Ferguson events featuring Democratic issues. Oh, and I'll also note, you know, no good family-friendly nonpartisan event would be complete without a completely innocent film screening.
I'm Marilyn Chase, and I'm here to announce the showing of a film called Bad Faith. It's going to start at 2 o'clock. It's a film about why Christian nationalism's unholy war on democracy.
Ah, yes, a film about white Christian nationalism's unholy war on democracy. It sounds like this pride event was absolutely normal and completely not unhinged in any possible way. Yeah, not an event I would be very interested in attending, but I will give it to them. I'm very glad that they decided not to strut little toddlers in front of adults dancing to Texas Hold'em by Beyonce and other such songs. So maybe there was like a little glimpse of sanity. There was a lot of blowback. In fact, I think, Nicole, one city councilman got in touch with us and he's like, wanted to be very clear, Nick Cohalo.
Yep, Nick.
He wanted to be very clear that he was not judging the kids' catwalk. He was a vendor. His business was a vendor at the event. So he's like, I want to distance myself from that insanity, which I was happy to hear. Like, who would want to be tied to that? So I want to start the show today by talking a little bit about, you know, why we're so passionate about trying to protect kids in the state of Washington. I mean, you know, we've gotten into some of these things that feel like it shouldn't be... They shouldn't be controversial. It shouldn't be controversial to say, nah, maybe we don't strut two-year-olds to nasty music in front of adults, right? Like, maybe that's just something that we all kind of agree on. Maybe we don't cut parents out of their kids' lives and assume that schools and the government can better handle a child who's going through, I don't know, a gender identity crisis. Maybe we don't do that. Maybe we trust that parents can deal with these issues in their own way and that the government has no place to get involved with that. And that was certainly the idea behind the Parental Bill of Rights and the Parental Rights Initiative that was passed into law by the legislature and became law in the state of Washington last Thursday, with some exceptions. So we all are waiting. I think this is a great day for parents. You know, they pushed for this. More than 400,000 Washingtonians signed this to say and to put their stake in the ground and say, no, parents are the primary stakeholder in their kids' lives. And we do not want the government, we do not want schools hiding things from us. That's not their job. We're the parents, they're the government. We're the parents, they're the schools. So you get more than 400,000 signatures. The Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature passed that initiative into law. It took effect on Thursday. And then, of course, what happened? Well, you have the ACLU that is trying to sue over it, saying that if it goes into effect, it's going to be harmful to families, to parents, and to queer kids and transgender kids. And then you have the superintendent of public instruction, Chris Rakedahl, who put out a statement and said, nah, I don't think we're going to follow this law. I don't think we're going to follow this law. We're going to continue to keep secrets from parents when it comes to gender identity in our schools. So what's happening right now with this? Well, it is law in Washington state, but there is still a legal case, a lawsuit moving forward by the ACLU. The ACLU tried to stop it from taking effect last Thursday at the last minute. They were not successful in getting a judge to grant that, but their lawsuit is proceeding forward. Now, here is the tricky thing about this. As we continue to try to fight for this initiative that the people wanted in the legislature passed. The tricky thing is, who defends the will of the voters? Who defends laws passed by the legislature in the state of Washington? It's Attorney General Bob Ferguson and his office. So call me crazy, but I don't have a ton of confidence that old Attorney General Bob is going to give it the old college try when it comes to giving the people of Washington and the legislature the best possible defense on the parental rights initiative. That's why I was very happy to hear that Pete Serrano, who is running for attorney general, but of course has been involved in some other legal challenges regarding state policy, he has stepped up to join, essentially, the defense of the Parental Bill of Rights and the Parental Rights Initiative. We spoke to him this morning about that effort. Pete Serrano, welcome back to Undivided.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Brandy.
Yeah, so we know the ACLU lost its effort to try to stop the parental rights law from becoming law on Thursday, but the case is still proceeding. So you are now getting involved on behalf of some other individuals. Explain what you are doing.
Yeah, so what Silent Majority Foundation did is we're representing Let's Go Washington, Jim Walsh, and Informed Choice of Washington. Obviously, as signature gatherers, collectors, and drafters, and sponsors, and financiers of the bill, the initiative 2081, which is now codified into law, thanks to the legislature actually doing its job, we feel that these individuals have the proper right to defend that as the ACLU and other folks sue the state of Washington to overturn these laws, requiring parental notification. And so I reached out to Jim, to Informed Choice of Washington, reached out to us, and we reached out to Let's Go Washington and said, hey, we want to make sure you have the ability to defend this, because we didn't hear anything from Ferguson's office. We weren't sure, you know, what type of defense he was going to mount to the actually making sure these laws stay intact. And so we wanted to make sure that Let's Go Washington's voice remains heard. Again, especially as the prime sponsor, Jim Walsh, and making sure that those voices of the parents of Washington continually remain at the forefront of the educational system. And so through the motion to intervene, we're saying, judge, we should be a party, or these individuals and organizations should be a party, and they should be able to mount these defenses to making sure that this law continually is upheld.
Yeah, so let's just touch on something you mentioned there. It is the job of Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General, to defend the will of the people and this law passed by the legislature, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I will say this, as you mentioned, there was an emergency temporary restraining order hearing last week, and the state did show up, in fact, and argue some of the salient points. I think there's a little bit more that we can add to the box of the litigation, as it were. I think there's a lot of really critical elements of historical law. There's what's called the mature minor doctrine. As I understand from one of the attorneys that works for us, Austin Hatcher, who attended the hearing, it got addressed, but very lightly. We believe that that element is a critical element to protecting parental rights and individual freedoms. And so we want to make sure that that is established as part of the case law in this challenge. Again, it sounds like the state did a fair job. But again, when we didn't hear anything from Bob Ferguson, and then, you know, about a week later, Chris Reichdahl basically comes out saying, well, I'm telling all the school districts they shouldn't be following this law.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's, I would say, confusion, but clearly it's not unintentional confusion. You know, there's direction from the leadership of the state and then silence from another part of the leadership. So we wanted to make sure that these resources that have been used to protect parental rights are well, you know, constrained, and that we have the ability to continually defend these rights. So yeah, I'm excited. I love the fact that we're here on behalf of the parents of Washington Silent Majority Foundation, just bringing this lawsuit or bringing this motion to intervene to make sure that your voice is heard.
Well, and I think it gives people a level of comfort, too. Again, you said the state, you know, did a good job on Thursday at getting the ACLU's motion for an emergency relief of sorts to be rejected. But I think for me, there's definitely a little reassurance that someone besides the attorney general is going to be looking out for the interest. But can I ask you, Pete, so wouldn't this mean that you and Bob are going to be working together on it? Like,
So here's the beauty. I mean, we are, as you know, Silent Majority Foundation's involved in several lawsuits against the state. And one of the attorneys, Mr. McGinty, is opposing counsel on several cases, and some of our discovery disputes are heating up. And so it's ironic that here we are chained together, as it were. I mean, technically, we're mounting similar but slightly modified defenses, but nonetheless, we're taking the same posture defending this law, as opposed to actually suing the state and saying, no, what you've done has violated my rights. And so it's going to be really intriguing to see how it is that we work together in this. You know, God willing, we're all professionals, and in this case, we happen to be on the same side, and we'll figure out a way to mount a really solid defense. You know, the state will do what it does. We'll do what we do to supplement that. There may be cases where we wholly, or instances in this litigation where we wholly rely on the state. Like, we see their brief and it's like, all right, that's where we were going anyway. And we'll save our space, right? I don't know that that will happen. And that's why we're seeking to intervene, to make sure that the parents' rights continually be heard and protected.
Yeah, there's something delicious about this unlikely partnership in the name of defending parental rights. I mean, in fairness, the state is obligated to. That's the Attorney General's office has an obligation to defend the will of the people in the legislature, and you're doing it because it's the right thing to do, but I digress. Yeah. I just want to end with this. When I heard Chris Rakedal, the superintendent of public instruction, last week say basically, kick rocks, our public schools are not going to do some of this. My first question, Pete, was, can he do that? Can the superintendent of public instruction just say, I'm not going to follow a state law?
I mean, I certainly don't believe he's has that ability. And I know I've been knocked for saying that when elected attorney general, I'll review and analyze laws. And if they're unconstitutional, I won't defend them. Right. Mm-hmm. And so here you have a case where there's no constitutional analysis or basis to say I'm avoiding this. I think if Rakedal had some sort of real basis in his statement, hey, it violates X, Y, or Z, there might be a fair case to be made, like, we're not going to follow the law.
Well, he does claim, he does claim that it violates federal privacy protections and HIPAA.
Yeah, he certainly claims that FERPA and HIPAA are in play, yet there was, in my opinion, if he's going to make the claim, he should have backed it up. And he certainly didn't do that. And I don't believe he's correct on those points either. And so unless he wants to come out with real analysis that actually says, here's how it violates these things, you know, that's why we believe it's in conflict with overriding laws, whether it's the Constitution or in this case, FERPA and HIPAA. You know, again, had he had a well-founded argument, I think there'd be a reasonable challenge, you know, where he might actually be right. Look, these laws violate X, Y, or Z, and they're in conflict, but he didn't say that. I mean, he tried to intimate that or claim that. So I don't think he's right. I mean, I think he's wrong. Yeah. And secondly, if he's going to do that, again, without really bringing forward the analysis, I don't think he should be out there cowboying and saying, hey, look, I'm just going to ignore these ones, especially when the same Chris Rakedal, mind you, 3 years ago, sent letters to school districts that weren't willing to, you know, force masks on children, and claimed, again, with the carrot stick of finances, to withhold funding from school districts that bucked the governor's order. He certainly didn't have the authority to do that, yet he used that as the tool to, you know, bludgeon these school districts with.
Yeah, and he's not a constitutional scholar, and he's not a jurist, and so he can believe these things, but it's almost like, well, follow the law, and then if the law is overturned or something and the ACLU wins, then fine, but who are you to make a unilateral decision that you're just not going to enforce it? You know, for the meantime, it's very strange to me. All right, Pete Serrano, we appreciate your time, and we appreciate you getting involved in this case to give parents a little bit of reassurance that this thing is going to be defended tooth and nail.
Well, that's the deal. Is, you know, I'm a parent myself. I want to make sure my kids have every right that they should have. And I want to make sure that my voice is heard, you know, when it comes to local school districts. So I'm fighting for my kids. I'm fighting for everyone else's kids. And again, to your point, the parents' voice that was heard not only through the initiative, but also through the legislature. And now it's up in question as to whether our voice really matters.
Yeah, we're going to find out whether our voice really matters. That's Pete Serrano with the Silent Majority Foundation. He's also a candidate for Attorney General. I guess he might team up with the current Attorney General to make sure that we get a good, strong defense of the parental rights initiative. Man, you think the fight's over one second, it's not over the next. And that's just typical, right? Everything that Democrats have done, and make no mistake, I mean, I think there are a lot of Democrats who passed this thing through the legislature knowing and supporting the ACLU and its effort to overturn it. And so you have, I guess, this continued effort to attack the initiative process and to not accept initiatives. I mean, look at $30 car tabs. How many times do we have to revisit the fact that we all wanted $30? Well, most of us, the sane ones, wanted $30 car tabs. Oh, can't get it. You know, they don't care about the initiative process. And that's why if they get a supermajority in Olympia, the first thing they're going to try to do is to get rid of the initiatives and the right of referendum, because they genuinely just do not care what you think or what you want. All right, I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Why? Well, it could save you a lot of money, and it could also make sure that you are that properly covered, or that you're not paying for something that you don't even need. Mike and I are members of the First Mark family. Personally, Nicole is as well. Our podcast is insured through First Mark Insurance. It's because it's a wonderful service, and it really pays to have an insurance broker on your side. Our friend Ben Bailey and his wife Leslie took the First Mark challenge, did a review of all their current insurance. First Mark went out, saved them $1,500 a year.
You know, more than anything, it was really kind of drilling down and looking at the current coverages that we have today. And if those were adequate for, you know, say, if we had a major incident here at the house, you know, were our cars covered adequately, or were they actually, in our case, over covered, right? We have one car that's fairly new, and another one that's, a few years old. And the one that was a few years old actually has had too much coverage on it. So that helped as well.
Yeah, Ben's is just one of many success stories we've heard from fans of the Undivided podcast who have now moved all their insurance over to First Mark to be handled through them. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Become a member of the First Mark family. Start by taking the First Mark challenge. It is totally free. In fact, you never pay First Mark for their services. All right, a Black-owned coffee shop in Seattle is saying that it is being absolutely destroyed by progressive policies and overtaxation. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. So this particular coffee shop first was on my radar. They were featured on a show on Fox 13, my former employee, called Back to Besa, where Besa went and visited this coffee shop in Seattle, a Black-owned business, to talk about what they're all about. Here's a clip from that story.
Hi, I'm Leona Moore Rodriguez, co-owner of the Station Coffee Shop. Welcome to our home. My husband and his brother started a coffee shop in 1994. And when we met in high school, I worked for them at their coffee shop called Java Love on Beacon Hill. Fast forward years later, we decided to open up our own coffee shop, and that's how the station began. There's just so much love and hard work that goes into it that is so satisfying to own a coffee shop, and to be Black and a woman to own a coffee shop is even more. It was so rare, and it's becoming more and more a reality for more Black women.
Yeah, and look, I think that's great. You guys know I'm not a big fan of identitarianism in terms of characteristics like your skin color or your gender determining, you know, how impressive something you do is, but I think that that's wonderful. She's obviously very passionate about the coffee shop that they've got up there, and I think that that is a passion and a sentiment that you would hear from a lot of small business owners who are like, I'm so glad to be able to be doing this. You know, I used to work at a coffee shop. Now to own my own coffee shop, how awesome is that in a neighborhood that I love and being able to do business with my friends and serve my community? I mean, that's a really cool thing. And so when I look at any business, whether it's Black owned or not, somebody who wants to go through the difficult task of starting a business, of running a business, that's not an easy thing, of having employees, of doing all the stuff that comes along with that, and, you know, not trivially paying taxes, dealing with government regulation. It is not easy to be a business owner. And so this coffee shop was featured on that Fox 13 segment. But what got a lot of attention after the fact is this post that the Station Coffee Shop put up on Facebook. You know, because I think the news story, it talks about, you know, the passion and all of that for owning a business. But then this Facebook post was the reality, really behind the scenes, of how difficult it can be to do something you love in a state where small businesses and business owners in general are simply not valued. This is, I want to read the entire post to you. It says, the station, like many other old businesses or new businesses, like our new shop, might not survive for long. The state of Washington is one of the most expensive states in the nation. Local businesses are forced to pay the city, the state, and the government taxes. Do you hear what I'm saying? Three different taxes. The station belongs to Leona and Lewis. We put 100 to 110% of our money, our work, our sweat, and our energy, but we can only make 10% of our revenue. But if we're really smart and good with our books, we can make 15% of our revenue, talking about their take-home pay. Both our shops have close to 20 young employees from our neighborhoods. And by the way we are going, I don't think that we will make it. It took a lot of energy and time for us to open, but most importantly, it took so much money. Now we're in a huge hole. It's really easy to blame owners for not paying their taxes or not running their business right, but guess what? We are doing all of that, and we are still drowning. Sometimes we can't even pay our rent or our employees because the government will pull $20,000 out of our account all at once. Honestly, I am ready to throw in the towel. What's the point of having two beautiful shops and making absolutely no livable income for us, the owners? If you know anyone or anything for us to do, please let us know. And in that, they tagged some very progressive politicians. And look, I don't know their politics. I'm not going to make an assumption about what their politics are based on what they look like or what city they live in. But this is the reality of progressive politics. This is the reality of what politicians in the city of Seattle and increasingly so in Washington State have done over a decade plus. They are crushing businesses, big and small. You know, they often like to talk about big business and, you know, all the efforts to go after Amazon, for instance, and tax Amazon to death, to the point where Amazon decides, okay, well, we're just going to pick up and we're going to start moving thousands of jobs across the lake over to Bellevue, a more business-friendly environment. And you had politicians in Seattle who are like, oh, well, if they don't want to be part of our city and contribute here in the way that we want them to contribute, then whatever, they can move to Bellevue. But what they fail to acknowledge and what they fail to admit is the impact that vilifying big businesses can have on small businesses as well. Look at some of the coffee shops that are in the area of South Lake Union in downtown Seattle, not this particular coffee shop, but other ones, other small businesses like laundromats, for instance, doggy daycares. They rely on a workforce to be able to have to make a living, to have people coming in the door. So when you vilify a big business like Amazon, all of a sudden overnight, you've got 10,000 people who aren't going to these coffee shops, dining at these restaurants, using the laundromats, dropping their dogs off for a trim or, doggy daycare. That is hurting a ton of small businesses because politicians in power chose to vilify large businesses. And so in the case of this coffee shop, you know, you have it being celebrated for being a Black-owned coffee shop owned by a woman. She's obviously very passionate about it. This is the kind of business owner that the city of Seattle says it's all about. I mean, you look at Mayor Bruce Harrell, when there were all these empty storefronts in downtown Seattle, what did he do? We want to fill them with Black-owned businesses. You know, we want to make Black-owned businesses feel like they can thrive in the city of Seattle. Well, Mayor, it takes a lot more than giving them a space and saying, here you go, run your business. Because they are still subject to all the overregulation, all the taxes that have started to accumulate, the high minimum wages to be able to make sure that they can have enough employees to run a coffee shop. They said they employ 20 young people from their neighborhood. I think that's great. But as the hourly rate continues to creep up and creep up and creep up, they're not making any more money. So what they're going to do is some of those young people just won't have a job. So it seems to be a lack of recognition, one, about what some of these progressive policies really do to businesses, big and small, including Black-owned businesses. And it also, frankly, seems to be a lack of recognition from people who tend to vote for progressive policies who just aren't able to put the pieces together to see, you know, oh, I'm mad about this. Like, I'm mad about crime, or I'm mad about taxes. I'm mad about what's happening to the coffee shop or the small business in my neighborhood that I love. There seems to be a lack of willingness to connect that with the party that's been in power in the brand of progressive politics that has got us to this place. And then on top of all of that, which isn't mentioned in this post, but on top of all of that, you are also victim to, as a small business, your environment. Is your environment, is your neighborhood a safe place to be? Is it a place where people want to go out on the streets and walk to your coffee shop or sit at your restaurant? You know, for downtown Seattle, huge swaths of downtown Seattle, that's not the case. And so you've seen small businesses shutter because people don't want to be there. So there's no customers down there for them. So if we want small businesses, big businesses, white-owned businesses, black-owned businesses, male-owned businesses, woman-owned businesses, if we want all of them to be able to thrive, which I think we do, right? We need to make sure that the business environment, the business climate, is good for all of them as well. So I hope that this coffee shop can make it, but I also hope that they recognize what caused over many years the struggles that they and so many other small businesses are now dealing with. That segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. If Bob Ferguson did not have his moral hypocrisy, he would have absolutely nothing. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. If there were a time as an elected leader, as anyone in a position of leadership, to speak out about retail theft, organized retail theft, that time would have been the summer of 2020. It would have been the summer of 2020 because those were some of the most egregious examples we had ever seen of organized retail theft. I was down in downtown Seattle when there were riots in the name of social justice. This is a video I took on my cell phone. Walking around the downtown Seattle core, seeing businesses looted to the studs, people walking away with handfuls of stolen merchandise, mannequins all over the street in the rain that had been stripped of what they were wearing, windows broken on just about every business, every retail shop in a 6-square block radius. That was organized retail theft done under the guise of a social justice protest, riot. Sure, there were some people on the street that day as we were covering it who were very much there because of George Floyd and who were peacefully assembled. But what it turned into was mass looting, mass rioting, organized retail theft, the worst case our state had ever seen. Although we had seen over that summer instances of this already happening in places like Minneapolis, for instance. And so it was only a matter of time before it happened here. I'd also note that some of those businesses that I, you know, filmed at the time that I saw looted to the studs, they've never, even today, 4 years later, they never opened back up. So it wasn't just a 4-hour period of destruction and downtown Seattle got right back on track. No, it never recovered from that. It was a really good thing at the time, though, that Attorney General Bob Ferguson came out with a really strong statement and said that his office, him as the chief law enforcer of the state of Washington, simply would not tolerate such behavior. Let's revisit what he said back then. What's that, Bob? Oh, that's right. He didn't say anything. The chief law enforcer of the state of Washington in 2020 had nothing to say about organized retail theft, the worst case of it our state had ever seen. He had nothing to say about it because it wasn't politically palatable to his base. This was started as a protest in the name of racial justice. So just because it devolved into mass criminal activity, well, he can't say anything about that. So he didn't say anything at the time. Well, then it happened in Bellevue as well. There were several stores in Bellevue, again, what started as a racial justice protest that devolved and provided cover for mass criminal behavior. The mall was looted. A jewelry store nearby was looted. A mattress firm broken into, looted. Happened in Bellevue just like it happened in Seattle. So surely I thought at the time, well, okay. You know, Bob didn't say anything about what happened in Seattle. Maybe he was in a coma. I don't know. Maybe there was a good reason why he didn't say anything. So then it happened in Bellevue. And finally, after it happened in Bellevue, Bob Ferguson, the state's chief law enforcer, finally found the courage to say something. Oh, that's right. He didn't say anything at all. He didn't say anything at all. But all of a sudden, when Bob Ferguson was starting to gear up for a gubernatorial campaign, all of a sudden, retail theft became a top priority for him. 2 years later, exactly 2 years later, after this mass rioting and looting in Seattle and in Bellevue, 2 years later, Bob Ferguson came out and gleefully announced, without acknowledging at all his past failure on the issue, that he was launching out of his office a retail theft task force.
Today, I'm announcing that my office is convening a statewide organized retail crime task force. The task force will improve coordination and collaboration among law enforcement agencies. And through enhanced coordination, we will better combat these multi-jurisdictional crimes that endanger employees, the public, and cause significant economic harm to our state.
Now, that would have been impressive had he done it 2 years earlier. That would have been impressive if Bob Ferguson, political implications be damned, as the state's chief law enforcer, came out, had a press conference, and said, we will not tolerate organized retail theft in our cities and in our state. And I am going to work to set up a retail theft task force. And we're going to track these people down. And we're going to arrest them. We're going to hold them accountable. No, he didn't say anything at the time because race was involved and he thought, can't do that. But when the public safety crisis proceeded to careen out of control, and when he realized that Jay Inslee wasn't going to seek another term, that he was going to be running for governor, well, he decided, well, I need to pretend that I cared about these crime issues the entire time. So he launches the retail theft task force, and now tackling retail theft is a core part of his campaign platform as he's running for governor. He sent out a tweet on his campaign account saying, organized retail theft is a serious problem. This is just a couple days ago, and we're taking action. Yesterday, my office convicted a man for stealing more than $140,000 worth of goods during 28 different thefts at Target stores in Pierce, King, and Kitsap counties. He's going to prison. On the same day, we filed a criminal prosecution for over 23 different thefts of $48,000 worth of eye drops. Exactly 2 years ago, I formed an organized retail crime task force. Last year, we secured resources for an investigations and prosecutions unit. Today, that unit is holding criminals accountable. We're sending a message that you cannot steal from Washington businesses with impunity. These crimes harm workers, shoppers, and our economy. As governor, I will invest additional resources into the Attorney General's organized retail crime unit. He says, we're sending a message that you cannot steal from Washington businesses with impunity. No, you're sending a message that you only care when people steal from Washington businesses when you're trying to run a campaign for governor. You're sending a message that you only care when people steal from Washington businesses when those people aren't part of your political base and when you don't rely on their votes to get elected. This is someone who, again, if he did not have his moral hypocrisy, he would have nothing. And if Bob Ferguson had come out, even two years later, and announced his retail theft task force, and if he had even mentioned, we watched what happened on the streets of Seattle and in Bellevue and other communities across our state. And you know what? We didn't do enough at the time. We want to do more now. It's become a bigger issue. Like a ounce of self-awareness, an ounce of humility. But there is not. And it goes well beyond what happened in 2020 during the riots. We've seen Target stores, you mentioned Target here, all over the place. The rest of us law-abiding people, what do we have to do? Well, we got to shop for things that are locked behind plexiglass. Because that's how bad retail theft has become. Like so many other issues, politicians like Bob Ferguson, politicians of his political persuasion, they wait until something reaches crisis levels. They wait until a majority of the populace is bothered by it. They wait until it could have electoral consequences if they don't do or say something about it. And then they act. That is the exact opposite of being a leader. That is the exact opposite of what we need in the next governor of Washington State. Unfreaking believable. All right, I have encouraged you guys, if you're thinking about selling your home, to get in touch with our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Wes has been doing this for a long time. He's been through all the ups and downs in the market. He helped sell Bryce and Carla's home. They are members of the Undivided family, and they were selling their home in Bellevue to move to Florida, and they were a little worried about the market. Like, they were selling in January, the rates weren't good. They were worried, you know, are we going to get the best possible price for our home? So they heard about Wes on our show. They reached out to him, and they were very, very happy with what he was able to do for them.
He was extraordinarily detailed, and he knew our neighborhood and our properties in the neighborhood very well. He gave us a really great comp plan, showed us what other properties were selling for. And most importantly, he helped us to understand the dangers of overpricing. And we thought what we knew we could get for the property, but we didn't, you know, at the same time, he breathed an air of reality into us, said, look, guys, you want to get that out of the property, you're going to need to start at a certain point, and you're going to let the market come to you. And that's exactly what happened. He was exactly right about that. So his knowledge of the market and his professionalism and his attention to detail is all that made the difference to us.
Yeah, they were able to sell their home in 7 days over list price by going with Wes Jones. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, dipping outside of Washington State, kind of. We're going to put 1 foot outside of Washington State and keep 1 foot firmly planted in Spokane. It is shocking to me how hate crimes are suddenly in the eye of the beholder. It's like, it's not a hate crime if I agree with what they're saying. You know, it's not a hate crime if I don't like the group that they're going after. And we see how even hate crime laws are manipulated to fit political agendas. It's absolutely insane. We have watched in our state and across the country what is undeniable hate crimes against Jewish people. We watched it happen on the campus of the University of Washington. We watched even more extreme examples elsewhere in the U.S. And then, you may have heard of this, in Spokane, there were some teenagers that vandalized a Pride sidewalk. Well, apparently that's a felony hate crime. But some of the clear hate crimes we've seen against Jewish Americans, not even worth speaking up about. There's an account on social media that put a side-by-side that I just could not help but think perfectly illustrated this point. So it had on the left the teens who were charged with a hate crime in Spokane for leaving skid marks on a Pride sidewalk. And then the right, though, which is at Lafayette Square in D.C., where you've got pro-Palestine, anti-Jewish protesters. I think that was where one of them was carrying like a severed head. It looked like a severed head of the president. Ah, free speech. Totally protected speech. Graffiti all over the statue. Like, just that property is destroyed. Property is destroyed. One of them's a felony hate crime. The other one, no big deal. I mean, the most insane double standard. And actually, Nicole was looking into this. The reason why what happened in Spokane was a felony hate crime is because Governor Jay Inslee had strengthened our state's hate crime law. Which, look, if it's across the board and it's applied, I'm not saying that destroying a Pride mural or whatever it is or anything like that, that's a crime. Yeah, I'm not saying that these people shouldn't be charged with something for destroying anyone else's property or public property. Whether it's a Pride sidewalk or whether you're knocking in the windows of a business that you're going to loot. Like, crime is crime. Absolutely. Throw the book at these little hellions. But when you ignore all the vandalism, for instance, that happened at the University of Washington, when you ignore that, you know, clear calls to for action, violence against Jewish people, when you ignore that, that's when I have a problem with it. This is from Crem 2, when the governor signed legislation redefining Washington State's hate crime laws. It says, Governor Inslee, this happened, he signed it back in March of this year. Governor Inslee has signed legislation to update the state's hate crime law to include defacement of public property. So it could go, you know, just vandalizing something, depending on what it was, could be a hate crime. And so it was interesting because we were looking into this law. And again, you just compare the two things. you compare, we used an example in Washington, D.C., because that's what that account had used side by side. But there are endless, endless examples that we could have used right here at home in Washington State to compare to the defacement of the Pride mural. How many, at one point at the University of Washington during the pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine protest, like they were defacing almost every building there. It was clear glory to the martyrs. I mean, literally, glory to Hamas from the river to the sea on all our beautiful old buildings. Have you seen any felony charges come out of that? No. Despite the fact that it fits very clearly. So skid marks on a pride mural, felony. Glory to the martyrs on a building at the University of Washington, look the other way. Not even worth a public statement. And again, it fits. I'll just read really quickly from the law. Substitute Senate Bill 5917. So it talks about adding, causing physical damage to or destruction of the property of another person, or, and so it goes through all these details. But that fits, okay, the pride thing, right? Like, yeah, you cause destruction to property. But also there are some specific lines in this related to religion. Defaces property of a victim who is or whom the actor perceives to be of Jewish heritage by defacing the property with a Nazi emblem, symbol, defaces religious real property with words, symbols, or items that are derogatory to persons of the faith associated with the property, places a vandalizer to face religious item or scripture on the property of a victim who is or whom the actor perceives to be of the faith which that item or scripture is associated, damages, destroys, or defaces religious garb or other faith-based attire belonging to the victim or attempts to be successfully removed, blah, blah, blah. So there's a whole section in there on religious stuff. Now, I get it that the buildings at UW weren't like a mosque or something. I get it that it wasn't a church, but still, it was clearly damaging public property for the purpose of hating Jewish people. I mean, man, I watched this press conference in Spokane where they were talking about, I think there was two instances in Spokane, weren't there? One was like a car that went through and like did donuts and stuff, and then there was another one. So I'm not sure which one the kids are accused of. You know, Nicole,
the kids are those scooter ones. They rented Lime scooters and did it, and so Lime has, you know, revoked their Lime privileges, or they set up a perimeter where you can't take your Lime scooter into the pride flag chalk thing.
So the kids put Lime scooters through pride sidewalk. Felony.
But, and like you were saying, that yes, this UW vandal was not on
church property,
but there was lots of that, and we have not heard much from law enforcement about who's been arrested for these things.
Right. How many Jewish buildings, how many synagogues on, how many times was a synagogue on Mercer Island vandalized?
Oh.
During this whole ordeal since October 7th. Endless times. Endless times. I have not heard anything, and I certainly didn't see a press conference of public officials when they were having the press conference in Spokane. And I'm not saying the Spokane thing isn't a big deal. If you break the law, I think you should be held accountable for it.
I do think maybe a felony for 16-year-old is a bit much. I would think it's maybe a misdemeanor.
Yes. But all I'm saying is they were crying. You had public officials who were crying. You see any public officials holding press conferences crying over the blatant anti-Semitism and hate crime attacks against Jewish people? No. It's really, but again, nothing. Moral. If they don't have moral hypocrisy, they have absolutely nothing. Okay, we're going to get to, some fun we had over the weekend. Nicole and I had a busy, busy weekend. We'll get to some questions and comments on the show. First, our friend Zach Abraham, Bulwark Capital. He's having another free inflation webinar to make sure that you understand, you know, how your retirement portfolio needs to consider inflation. So they are going to have this coming up on June 27th. With everything going on, I mean, costs through the roof. If you're nearing retirement with inflation so high, the retirement you planned for is the amount of money you saved going to get you there. And that's what Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital can walk you through. They call inflation the silent portfolio killer, because you might have done a really great job of saving for retirement, and then inflation goes nuts and all of a sudden you just can't afford what you thought you were going to be able to afford. So don't miss Zach's special inflation webinar, June 27th at 3:30 p.m. p.m. Pacific time. Sign up right now for free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Go to KnowYourRiskRadio.com. When you go there, it'll pop up on your screen and you can just sign up to go. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to KnowYourRiskRadio.com. We had a fun weekend, man. We did. Saturday was really busy. We went to the Maple Valley Days Parade with Team Reichert, and also to try to collect signatures for Initiative 2066 before it's too late. What a great showing for Dave Reichert. You know what's funny? We have so many funny stories from this. So people loved him there. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
He was getting, like, standing ovations on the parade route. We're there for 5 minutes all gearing up and ready to march. And this guy, he was walking in with a bunch of students from a marching band, it looked like. Mm-hmm. And he goes over, beelines it for Dave, shakes his hand and says, "I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm voting for you for governor." I was like, yes, I love it. But then should I tell him about the Bob Ferguson person?
Yes, that's my favorite story.
So Nicole and I are sitting, we're standing all getting ready, mm-hmm. you know, gearing up for the parade and stuff. And there's this woman in a Bob Ferguson t-shirt with a Bob Ferguson sign, because Bob Ferguson had like six people in the parade who were marching with him.
Literally.
He wasn't there, that's but like six of them. Yeah.
There was about six lined up.
Yeah.
And they didn't, we handed out candy. We handed out dog bones.
Dog treats.
We handed out flyer stickers, all the things. And they had six people in a line.
Yep. No, it was embarrassing. But then also, they were so rude. So we're sitting in this parking lot and we're just getting our t-shirts on and stuff. And this one singular woman with the Bob Ferguson stuff walks by us, and Nicole and I were standing right there. And I'm like, hey, this is awkward, so I'll just make mm-hmm. a joke. And I'm like, hey, it's not too late to change t-shirts and march with us. She didn't say a word. She's like,
she kind of just walked by. Mm-hmm.
And then went to her car.
Parked next to
us.
Right next to where Dave was standing. Yeah. And so it was like she felt awkward walking by us. And so she just looked straight ahead and would not acknowledge you. Did not look at us.
Not
nothing.
Even like nothing. I'm like, really? I'm making a clear joke. And then later on after the parade was done, I had looped back around to find a bathroom. And the Bob people were all standing waiting to get off the parade route. The six of them or whatever. And I was like, ah. And they didn't even look. They're like, okay. So they were just typical.
Typical.
I wanted to scream, go back to Seattle.
Like, fun and
not any
it's
fun.
A parade.
We had a blast though. So we also collected signatures for 2066 on the parade route, met a lot of nice people, and then we decided to go to Enumclaw and we had lunch in Enumclaw. Man, I love Enumclaw. And then we went to the Rainiers game.
Yeah, we had a busy day.
All over the place. So we're gonna have a lot of stuff coming up this summer. We'll be talking about on the show this week. In fact, there's a barbecue coming up on Saturday we're going to be at. We should talk about that on the show tomorrow. How does that sound? Okay, let's get your daily subscriber show poll. This was just a fun one because I've been thinking about this a lot lately, about words and phrases and labels that just have completely lost their meaning because they're entirely overused. It's like if somebody on the left calls me a racist, I'm like, okay, like that doesn't even bother me anymore because you've called me a racist like a million times. Or if someone on the right calls me a rhino, I'm like, well, I'm not even a Republican, so I'm not sure that phrase applies to me, but you do you. So anyway, I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, what phrase or label do you believe has lost its meaning the most? Right wing, threat to democracy, Nazi, or transphobe? Nicole, what do you think? What has most lost its meaning?
I would say threat to democracy.
I kind of agree because that's the most significant.
Right.
Everything's a freaking threat to democracy. Mm-hmm. Let's see. On Patreon, 64% of people agree. Mm. Hugh says, we hear right wing often in a disparaging way. Why not the same level of usage of left wing with the same kind of animosity? Well, I know the answer. I say that all the time. Like, for instance, whenever somebody in the media writes an article about me, they call me a conservative political podcaster. Do you think that they ever call like a liberal political podcaster liberal or progressive? No, they would just say political podcaster or host. It's never, you know, it's like Tucker Carlson's a conservative host, but you think that Rachel Maddow is referred to as a progressive liberal host? No, it's like they have to have that qualifier on the right, mm-hmm. but not so much on the left. Kayla Smith, threat to democracy seems to be a blanket statement used mostly by the left, but others as well, to generalize an idea one thinks should be universally dismissed as bad. Threat to democracy on both is pretty overused, but much more so by the left. Kathleen, they have all lost their true meaning. I do think the Nazi word is used too much, especially by people who have no concept of the atrocities committed under Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. I have to acknowledge, though, for the amount of time, like, the left called Trump supporters Nazis for 6 years straight, and now they're kind of the ones acting like Nazis. So, I mean, life comes at you fast. Joel, I wish you had a category, all of the above, because they're all pertinent, which the racist one really bothers me, because obviously there is true racism out there in the world. But I'm sorry, when you call everything racist, nobody takes you seriously anymore. It's crying wolf. When you call everyone a transphobe because they want to have legitimate conversations about, I don't know, whether kids should undergo life altering surgery, transphobe, then nobody's going to like take you seriously on that anymore. So I worry about the spring back effect. I worry that people got so offended by everything in the world, pretty soon we're going to be offended by nothing. And I don't think that's particularly good either. I mean, some things are offensive and shouldn't be said or done, but we shall see. Let me see here. Let me get one more comment in on that. Yeah, a lot of you are just saying all of the above. Shirley, I don't think threat to democracy or Nazi have lost their meaning. They have been redefined and misused. There is a true threat to democracy. It's called socialism and communism. Transphobe is certainly a meaningless term as well. All right, let's get to other questions and comments from the show today. Stealth Creations with a $2 super chat just says, cool. What's cool?
I'm not really sure, but it was during the beginning of the show. So either Pete, something you said in that cool. opening.
I'm cool.
Maybe it was that the catwalk got canceled.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Jeff Monahan, wait, HIPAA is still in play? I thought we threw that out the window in 2020 with all the needing to provide proof of that shot they called a vaccine. That's true. Why didn't we have, wasn't HIPAA a big deal there? We had to show that thing to get in freaking everywhere. Well, I guess it was a choice, right? You can show it or you can't come. So maybe that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Greg Anderson, guy, I still regret doing that. Stupid. How lame was I? I got a little piece of paper and used it to get into places. Stupid, Brandy. What's wrong with you? Greg Anderson, small businesses better wake up and realize that the government is not going to help them specifically. The Democratic Party is not going to help them with their business or their life. And look, I don't know that we need to help businesses per se. And I've said this before, I don't think it's the government's job to make our lives better. I just don't want the government to make our lives worse. So putting so many taxes, so many burdens, so many regulations on businesses where you are preventing them from succeeding, that's really the problem. I don't think that the government needs to or should be propping up businesses that are, for instance, poorly run, mismanaged, whatever it is. That's the free market will take care of that in and of itself. But when the government's putting its foot on business owners and stomping them into the ground, that's the issue I have. Suzanne says, I hate shopping at Target now. I have to keep calling employees to get all my toiletries out of lockup. I've said it before. I wish I had invested in like a plexiglass company 6 years ago.
Right. I know. Still, when you go to the doctor, everybody has plexiglass. I cannot hear through those things. So I'm always leaning down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're over the thing. And I'm like, can I get my prescription?
It's but exhausting.
Then also just everything locked up. It's a 45-minute ordeal if you want a razor out of the thing at Bartell Drugs.
Yep. You got to find somebody, ring them
up. Well, and then this one time I needed one of those razors that's for like your lip hair,
Don't give away beauty secrets.
Sorry, you know, I grow hair on my lip. What do you want from me? I also have a couple long ones on my chin. What do you want from me? So, you know, I wanted a little, that's specifically what it's for, right? And so I'm like, I'm not going to ask this dude to get me my lip shaving thing out of there. I'm not doing that. So then I'm just SOL.
Yep. Well, that's sad. But it's now you've told everybody. You were worried about that one guy, but now you've told everybody.
That's true. But these are my friends. I don't know that guy. I don't know who he's going to tell. So okay, I have to shave my lip. What do you want from me? Nicole, do you ever have to shave your lip?
Well, yeah, but you're making it seem like we're like, man, let's get some shaving cream.
I'm not saying I'm growing a stash. It's just a little blonde hair. And then I got one here. It grows an inch a day.
It ain't easy.
If they could figure out, medically speaking, right?
I know.
Bottle up how this chin hair grows an inch a day. They could solve baldness. They could solve baldness. Because like this is the fountain of youth for hair happening here on my chin.
Yeah, it's funny because you have one right now, but I had one too. And then you hit 40 and you find a few more every month.
If you ever want to know why your friend who's a girl, why the woman you're dating, why your wife has a tweezers in her car, it's because every woman plucks their chin hairs in their car because it's the best place to see them. So if you're ever like, why do you have a tweezers? That's why.
That's why.
Way
or
off
if
track.
If you see somebody sitting at a bar and they're like this, it's because we found one and we can't get it.
Anyway, wow, getting old. Okay, Dawn says, just like if an individual used a gun to shoot another, it can't be blamed on the rest of the gun owners. Good God, hypocrisy 101. What's that in reference to? I can't think of a story that fits with.
Well, no, it's the hypocrisy in the enforcing the vandalism on the pride flag, right. But not on it.
Yeah. Egamorph 2, the only thing I like about Chris Reichdahl is that he would come on Dory's show. Don't agree with him on 99% of stuff, but did appreciate that he didn't hide from Dory. Yeah, he's been on our show too. Mm-hmm. And I've told him that when he comes on, is I really do appreciate his willingness to, you know, he understands that he's a public servant, so we might not agree with him. And he comes in knowing that full well, but he still comes in. So that is the one thing I've given Chris Reichdahl credit on. Bonnie, all pride groups are given special treatment. I'm sick of all pride celebrations shoved in our faces. I don't care about anyone's sexual preferences. To each its own, it doesn't make a person better. I agree. It's a sexual thing, I think, right? It's like your preferences for who you want to sleep with or marry or love or whatever it is. But when I go to a Kraken game and I'm trying to watch hockey and people fight and the entire game is around pride and it's just everything is covered in pride, mm-hmm. and they're talking about pride in every single commercial break, I'm like,
you're not doing yourself any favors.
Well, yeah, give it a rest.
Or the cause any favors, I guess.
I agree.
Because I think it just makes people shut it down, shut it off.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. Tim Clemenson. Hi, Tim. Signed the initiative on Saturday. Told my two friends that they had to sign it too, or I would throw a tantrum in their car. I love that. When we were in Maple Valley, and again, we were marching, and we had the copies of the initiative with us, like every person in Maple Valley had already signed it. They're like, I already did it. Yeah. I already did it. I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys are just great.
Yes.
I just love you guys. Maple Valley, those are our people, man.
Yes, absolutely. So,
and I would also tell you guys, I said when Nicole and I went out, no idle hands this summer. Nicole and I have events that we're doing, like, it seems like every free day we're not working. No idle hands, whether you have never volunteered mm-hmm. for something. And I don't care if you want to volunteer for a different campaign or whatever it is. Or collective focus as people with common sense. Nicole looked at me. Unless it's Bob Ferguson's campaign, obviously. I don't want you volunteering for Bob Ferguson's campaign.
You don't know that.
But genuinely anyone else. We have a huge task ahead of us. We have to literally save the state from destruction. And so no idle hands. If you've got a free Sunday, reach out to a campaign you like, whether it's at the local level or a state level campaign. Tell them, I have a free Sunday. Can I sine wave somewhere? Can I do something here? And do it. And it's fun and it's great. And you can meet people who are also sane. And every little bit helps to save this state of ours from destruction if Bob Ferguson is elected the next governor, or if Democrats expand on their majority. So like I said, I don't, at whatever level, find something to do, collect signatures for 2066. This stuff is so easy and they're desperate. Everyone's desperate for volunteers. Political campaigns, whatever it is, they're desperate for volunteers and you will love doing it. So find something to do. Find one free day you have and put aside a couple hours to do it. March in a parade, something like that. Okay. Wow, I'm just bossing everyone around today. Okay, should we get to our closing sanity check? It's a good one.
Okay, sure.
Thanks, well, Nicole.
Let me get off me.
Bye. I like your color shirt today, by the way.
Oh,
purple looks very nice on you.
Oh, thanks.
Very nice. With that, let's get to our closing sanity check. I really think that we're starting to see people wake up when it comes to what's happening to kids, specifically around surgeries that are irreversible. And, you know, a lot of you have had moments, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years in particular, where people were telling you you're on the wrong side of it, you're on the wrong side of it, you know, related to COVID or whatever it was. And you've come out of it like, I was right. I stood by what I believed in. I was right. And now I can live my life knowing that I stood up for what was right when it was really difficult to stand up for what is right. And now there are some doctors in the United States who are doing just that on the issue of transgender interventions for kids.
Despite recent revelations from the leaked WPATH files and the recent release of the final report from the CAST review, these medical organizations have not changed course. So we are calling on these medical organizations of the United States, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, the Pediatric Endocrine Society, the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, to follow the science and their European colleagues and immediately stop the promotion of social affirmation, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgeries for children and adolescents who experience distress over their biological sex. In our declaration, we affirm that sex is a dimorphic, innate trait defined in relation to an organism's biological role in reproduction, male and female. This genetic signature is present in every nucleated somatic cell in the body and is not altered by drugs or surgical interventions. Consideration of these innate differences is critical to the practice of good medicine and to the development of sound policy for children and adults alike. Medical decision-making should be based upon an individual's biological sex. It should respect biological reality and the dignity of the person by compassionately addressing the whole person. We are here defying the claims made by these medical organizations in the U.S. that those of us who are concerned are a minority and that their protocols are consensus. They are not consensus, and we are speaking in a loud, unified voice. Enough.
Enough. Doctors like that one, other doctors who have spoken out, who have pointed to research and what's happening in other areas of the world that are moving away from this practice of making changes to children that they will have to live with for the rest of their lives. Those people will be on the side, the right side of history. It is only a matter of time. That has been your sanity check for today, and that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. If you have not signed up to support the show already, you can do it for just $5 a month. Sign up at undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. You can also shop our merch store while you're there, and I just again would leave you with the reminder, no idle hands from now to November. Find a way to improve this state we're living in to help set it back on the right track. Nothing you can do, have time to do, is too small. So look for something that you can get involved in today. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.